Welcome to Back Channel. We interview talent professionals who are helping the fastest growing companies place their leadership teams. On today's episode, we have Allie Smith from STG. Welcome, Allie. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here. Appreciate you having me. Great.
Absolutely. So getting started, let's hear a little bit about you, your firm, and your role there.
So I joined STG in the capacity to help with our talent initiatives and anything human capital. So that includes not only search and talent acquisition across the portfolio, but also helping from a systems perspective, track data around anything to do with people, also with leadership and the strategic initiatives we have around retention across the assets as well. And then we do a few live in-person events for our leadership teams. So I help coordinate those as well. I do report into a managing director and the head of talent for all of STG, Kelly Carlson, that she's been a fantastic mentor and I've worked alongside her before. So it's a dream job to be able to walk in and have such a breadth of opportunity and the ability to come and really help just a great, fantastic team.
Getting started with our questions, for our listeners who might have been under a rock, the last few months have seen a lot of market uncertainty, particularly in the tech space. With that said, it seems to always be a candidate's market for top-tier talent. I'm curious what challenges you've seen recently and what you're doing to adapt.
So we've seen candidate behavior definitely shift from what used to be taboo to candidates taking counteroffers, even accepting roles that are outside of their own functional areas to include more P&L ownership or even general management responsibilities when they've been in a tactical functional role. We've seen leaders move into different functional areas and take larger compensation packages when they've gone to resign after accepting new roles to leave their current business and then stay. So there are behaviors of candidates that are shifting. We are staying very true to what we know best at STG. And I would say that is knowing what executives partner very well with our deal team and what the business growth and strategy per asset really is. And we do a lot of work on the talent side specifically, really ensuring that the experience of the leader we're looking for and the leveling will actually garner the results of the strategy for growth. And what I mean by that, Mike, is there are times where a high potential candidate that is looking to take a step up and gain more responsibility that may be layered under a fantastic leader and mentor, but isn't moving for another 2 to 3, maybe even 4 years, dependent upon a hold time or, you know, their compensation package and, you know, equity payout. And so we are getting creative around structuring, I would say, not only roles and functions, so we're able to extend our parameters of the talent that we're looking at, but we're also opening up the aperture of proven track records. So giving candidates the opportunity to take that step up in their career, but also providing support, right? So if they haven't been in a, you know, leadership role where they've had the purview over X amount of people and that, you know, for them is a new skill set, we'll really put together a team around them to ensure that they have the ability to win and, you know, they're set up for success. So it's getting creative around more of the qualitative components, I would say, of the candidate process and the onboarding process. And then also just during the search, ensuring that we're really identifying the backgrounds and the experiences holistically that can work for the opportunity.
And you mentioned, you know, staying competitive. A big piece of that is compensation, right? I think it's no surprise that executive compensation is at all-time highs. According to our data, it was actually up another 4% last quarter. With the massive inflation that we're seeing, you know, I guess globally, and also from the executive comp perspective, I'm curious how you're advising portfolio companies to stay competitive and when to go all in and when to hold back.
Yes, it's an interesting topic. It's a hot topic, especially when you're in private equity and most everything ties back to cost or an EBITDA number. And at STG, we have great portfolio parity across all assets, and we do track that for compensation at every functional level. And so for STG, our assets, and I don't want to speak for our leaders, but I would really go to bat to say that most of them subscribe to the mentality of wanting leaders in the business with them, rowing in the same direction, that are there for the betterment of the business and the growth of the business. And compensation is a byproduct of that, versus the leading, you know, indicator or reason why they're exploring an opportunity or looking to join a specific business. And one instance that I've shared previously, we had a client, I was actually working at True, and we had a fintech client where they had set compensation, cash compensation and equity at a flat $300,000 for the entire executive team, zero bonuses, and all equity was the same. And it was because the founder and the CEO of the business had such a tight strategic roadmap to file an S1, to get through an IPO. It was realizable. They saw the opportunity in the market, and they really wanted to recruit the executives into the business across all functions that bought into that same methodology. And it was, we're here to grow a business and to make, it was a mission oriented business as well. They are AB Corp. And it was really understanding that is the fabric of the business. That's the culture. They really are there as servant leaders. And so it's understanding whether you're a search professional or just an employee of your business, how does your company really look at compensation? Is it a motivating driver? Is it, you know, something that is more collectively, transparently shared? I think that there are a lot of dynamics that employees need to understand, either if they're going through an interviewing process or walking into a manager or, you know, mentor's office, or hopping on a Zoom these days and asking for a raise or asking for a little bit more clarity, to know that you can ask those questions and to really understand it. And then if you're going through a recruiting process, understand what market's getting paid. Ask that recruiter, right? Functionally, this is where I am today. Where's market? Or this is the range that I'm seeking. Where is market today? Just to understand, you know, benchmarking wise from someone that's in the trenches every day, what that is. If you're a hiring manager, if you're interviewing firms before you're running a search, ask the question, see if they have a good answer. If it's completely off the mark or 5% higher than what you've read or seen, maybe not the search partner for you.
It's helpful to really get the context between the depth of the situation, because it's, you know, money obviously matters to everybody, but there's a value alignment, it sounds like, that really needs to be met first, and then figuring out what, you know, the best compensation is to align with that metric, right?
A line I like to use, Mike, is I know everyone needs to buy milk and keep the lights on. So what cash range are you looking for? And especially in this dynamic, right? A lot of people don't want their entire compensation tied up in an equity package. So they, if they're the sole earner for their home, or they're a single individual, you know, they may want a bit more in cash. And so to have that conversation upfront especially for talented leaders that may have an offer or two or three in hand when they're moving through final stages of multiple conversations with multiple businesses. I think and gracefully, right? And to do it at the right juncture, not to put anyone out, but it is a piece of the discussion that I think a lot of people are having intelligently, and a lot of candidates are advocating for themselves.
Yeah, that makes total sense. To shift gears here to a very important topic of DE&I, it's been, you know, top priority for years. We do a survey and it showed up top of the list for the last 3 years, at least for us, since we've been doing that survey. And that's really encouraging. But I think when you look at it, there's still a variety of approaches. And there's a lot of work to be done to really address the overall challenge that is in front of us, right? I'm curious of your thoughts around those approaches and just your thoughts in general about DE&I.
Yeah. So when I, not to take you through the walking uphill in snow without shoes story, but 12 years ago, I joined one of the Schreck firms, and I was coming out of an audit role where it was 2007, 2008, auditing banks, closing down banks, merging banks, a lot of board conversations in boardrooms of banks in my early 20s, and no one looked like me. Maybe the partner I was with for my accounting firm, for my audit firm, but outside of that, most of the leaders were non-diverse, gender nor ethically, and I didn't understand why. That was just a big question I continued to ask. And as you peel back the layer of that onion, there's reasons, and not most of them are very acceptable from my definition or standpoint. And I was introduced then to a managing director that I was working alongside in search that had the same passion for, it was at that time, diversity and inclusion. So just D&I. And we were very driven to set up a diversity practice across the firm. We ran one of the first chief diversity officer searches for financial services, which was just a massive win. It was a brand new function. Affinity groups were starting to become a new thing, where whether you were coming from the military or you were passionate about gender, even maybe you were a parent in a business and there weren't many. So you started a group that was more supportive of that point in a life journey. So that was a really great experience, a really fun time to see transformation, to see 25 to 35 year tenured executives change their mentality around hiring, around retention. And then from there, I would say venture started to have a very loud and strong voice advocating for diversity and inclusion as well. And private equity, I would say, is on that journey. And there's a McKinsey study that just came out last month where they did a lot of data analysis comparative to public companies, and private equity in the entry and mid-level roles at the firm level. So private equity firms specifically have a increased number of diverse talent than public companies. Now, when you look at senior level management, so managing directors or the C-suite, that diminishes quite a bit. So the public companies are, I think, at 27%, and private equities at even 11 or 15% of diverse leadership at the MD level and above. Now, why is that, right? Are you looking at retention numbers after the acquisition of diverse talent? And what are the structures that are in place to really help from a performance management standpoint retain those individuals? So I can talk about this topic for a very long time.
Yeah, it's an important one. We should. I mean, staying on that topic, the path just is so interesting. I'm sure it gives you a very unique and strong perspective around it. I'm curious, what you're doing in your current role, you know, even tactically to approach the issue, both from a fund perspective as well as advising portfolio companies. Sorry.
Yeah. So at a fund perspective, we do report our metrics across to our partnership groups. And with that, we have a lot of help from the portfolio companies understanding what those numbers are, right? So we're very, I would say, early on in the journey of collecting the data, setting the strategy, and really defining what diversity means for each asset, both from a geographic standpoint. We have global assets, so helping understand what diversity means for that specific business, and then carrying that through even to our search partners as we look at the talent acquisition strategy, and really ensuring we're working with the teams that hold their own firms accountable, and the search partners that measure their success in the area as well. So we're really, you know, it's a triage. We're looking at it from all sides, both, you know, from an individual perspective, right? So holding your own bias accountable and making sure that you're coming to the table individually, but then also, you know, at the firm level, at the sponsor level, we measure it. We have a great group of diverse talent here. You know, Kelly being a managing director, being diverse, and then all across our entire deal team and ops team as well. And then, like I said, you know, the reporting from the portfolio companies does get distributed. And so we had a really fun, I call it fun. It was collaborative, it was productive, it was strategic, but fun also. CEO summit where we were able to have all of the leaders compare diversity stats. And when you get private equity leaders talking about numbers, it turns competitive quickly. And it was motivating, and it was great to just see how bought in most leaders are.
Yeah, that's encouraging to hear. And when you mention tracking and measuring effectiveness, I think that's probably a newer thing. You know, I'm curious of what mechanisms you're using to do that for the benefit of our listeners who might not be tracking that today.
You know, I think it's, Mike, a lot to do with the up-leveling of the human resource and broader people function. They really advocate as business partners to cross-functional leaders around the health of the business. You can measure culture. You can measure employee NPS. However you're measuring a client or a customer, you can measure your own employees the exact same way. They essentially are your biggest client or customer. They're advocating for you in the market negatively or positively, no matter what. And so if you're a leader or a manager or even a coach, mentor, if you have the ability to hear another employee or coworker, really understand what the impact or personal, you know, kind of motivators are for someone, is there a way to manage, to motivate, to measure? And then from there, it's understanding what's working, what's not. Are the numbers where they need to be? And if not, why? And just re-asking that question, why? Are we losing, you know, is attrition high? Okay, why? Is it in a certain function? Is there a specific portion of a diverse group that is leaving the business? And just understanding it's a bit of pattern recognition, right? So this will take a few cycles if it's a business that hasn't been looking at these metrics before. And I would really say to people that are starting on a DE&I journey, it is just that. It's a journey, and it's been one that's been developing over, I would say, the past decade. We've included equity. Like I said, it was DE&I. And so it's taking on new forms. And I think it will continue to do so as new generations enter the workforce, and they define it differently too. And so it'll be an area where people will have to continue to open up to new ways of thinking, new ways of working, and then new ways of measuring.
Yeah, it seems like the only way real change happens, right?
Hey, what doesn't get measured doesn't get changed. I don't know who said that, so don't. I'm probably quoting someone that's not
Peter.
Not me.
Peter Drucker, I think.
There you go.
I love the theme of using go-to-market metrics in HR. It makes a ton of sense. And I think the same applies to strategy, right? So a long-held belief on the go-to-market side is how much more cost-effective it is to retain an existing customer versus acquire a new one, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing applies with your people. Retaining top talent and keeping them and developing them over time versus going out and acquiring new talent, it seems like the same logic would apply to effectiveness, right? But at the same time, on the go-to-market side, many companies are still laser focused on customer acquisition and many talent teams are still laser focused on talent acquisition. Mm-hmm. How do you balance this dynamic and how do you advise your portfolio companies to do the same?
That's so interesting. I think to use kind of that go-to-market lens, when you're thinking about customer acquisition and then your current suite of products or services or your brand, how are you working with your customer to evolve? Your customer needs, your employees' needs, right? They will evolve. Your business will evolve. There's a metric that every time a business from a headcount perspective or a revenue perspective triples, so every 3x, is massively different. You're solving different problems. You either need different leaders or you need to train your leaders differently to achieve that next stage of strategic growth. And so how is that support happening, right? And as your business grows, your leaders' lives are changing also. And so it's that continuous feedback cycle that I've seen work extremely well, real-time feedback, not waiting for a year, 12 months to go by for a performance review, having the mechanisms in place where that cycle of feedback, both upward, peer, direct report feedback is more immediate. Things are moving more quickly. In private equity, deals are happening, I think, at a 20% velocity and speed increase than what they were previously. That might be slowing down right now. How are you training your people to move more quickly? Are you giving them better technology or better tools? And then I think also for retention, and for, thinking through transformation or maybe businesses that need to level set or maybe coming into a cost restructuring, situation, having touch points with employees, making communication so clear and concise and being very transparent around the state of play goes such a long way. And just hearing people, I think, as well, and just understanding, kind of tying it back to the measurement and the data, understanding where to help. I think leaders often feel there are blind spots, but you can really quickly through whether it's a culture amp survey or even, a type of tool. We use Criteria Corp as a partner at times. I've used Hogan previously. So are there leaders that do really well in stressful situations? Are there leaders that don't? Do you know leaders that potentially work better in office, these days? Are they able to, get the work environment that best supports them? And if not, what other tactics or tools are available for them to really perform? So I think there's a lot of different avenues that leaders can take.
Yeah, I think it's hard to talk about employee development and employee retention without talking about compensation. They're kind mm-hmm. of hand in hand. And, I'm curious, we mentioned comp earlier, but in what scenarios do you advise portfolio companies to pay up to retain that talent versus kind of letting them go. You see a lot of job hopping right now, and it's an effective way to get a significant raise. But, you know, what can a portfolio company do to retain those employees without breaking the bank?
Yeah, I think, again, it's really understanding an employee's own career journey and asking questions around where they see themselves developing, where they want to develop, where, you know, capacity constraints are, and really ensuring, again, back to that performance cycle. And I'll use private equity just in general as an example. So when looking at those entry-level employees and the non-diverse and the disparity of compensation at the kind of MD and C level, asking the question why, and then really understanding the ability to make the change, what needs to change, why it hasn't changed, and who are the individuals that have the power to make it change, and what needs to occur for their mentality to shift is one. And that's no small mountain to climb. I clearly understand that. But it's also giving high performers the ability to do just that, getting out of the way. True did a great job of this. The performance review cycle was every 6 months. There was zero ceiling on an entrepreneurial spirit. So if that's the DNA of your culture, really allow that to thrive. Give folks room to have the capacity to explore areas that may be new to the business. For a go-to-market strategy, if you have a sales leader that's in the trenches talking with a customer, they've partnered, you know, either with the support or service team or maybe even product, and there's a new revenue stream that could potentially unlock an entire white space of of a vertical for a business, and there's the ability to explore that. I mean, that's a high potential employee's dream or one, you know, that I've heard of. And so I think it's giving them the at-bats, giving them the opportunities outside of just compensation. And once the role, give them the opportunity, and Brad and Joe at True used to say this, give folks the opportunity to do the role before they're ready. It scares them shitless, right? So they go into it super hungry. They want to win. They want to do what's right, you know, for the business, for the client, et cetera. But then also, as they move through that experience and they have the support, so obviously don't throw them in the deep end without the support or the education or the tools, but they have the ability to then echo that and allow that opportunity for the next high performing individual within your business. And that snowballs. And those are the types of employee recognition that really, I think, move the needle. Maybe it's getting, if you're at the PE firm level, we run something called the Leadership Academy, where we identify high performing leaders, and it not that it's a boot camp or a training platform, but you could turn it into that, right? You could have a couple of day summit or, you know, event where you're getting the brain trust of everyone together, to have those moonshot conversations, get people out of their day-to-day for a minute, and just really recognize the fact that there are some fantastic, you know, people and just really smart individuals working in the four walls or on, you know, online with you every day.
I really appreciate the openness and like the depth of context that you're providing for each of these questions. I feel like we could have gone hours longer. We're going to have to do a follow-up session.
Anytime.
But approaching our last question here, we asked this to all of our guests. It's around a contrarian view. So what best practices, beliefs, or habits from the executive search space do you disagree with or do you think should evolve?
So I would say candidate custody is one. And another, so Bill Chisholm, our CIO here at STG, is such an advocate. And I'll plug the podcast for back channels. And so another one that I would love to see fall by the wayside are formal references. Those are teed up slam dunks. It's ensuring that a candidate is branded in a very positive light. I appreciate that. I respect it. I will have those conversations all day, every day. There's always something to learn. Kelly taught me that from every conversation you have. But also, a back channel is the detail that you need, right? A employee, a candidate, a reference can say all day that the same talk track. You get a back channel on the phone of someone that may have crossed paths with that individual, and you put the word confidential in front of it and truly keep it confidential. There's so much you can learn from just how somebody interacted every day or how they showed up. There's other tools to use too, more forensic referencing where we've uncovered some wild things about candidates. That another podcast for another day. But yeah, I would say those two and candidate custody by definition. Some firms back in the day, I'm not certain if it's any longer in practice. I really hope not. But if it is, it's where candidates, as they reach a certain point in a search process, that's typically meeting with a management team or a hiring team. No other search partner in that firm can present that candidate to any other client. True operates differently. I know other firms operate differently, so it's not everyone out there, but I do really think that there is a level of horsepower that ramps up when clients know and other, the candidates know what other opportunities are out there. It makes everyone just really put on their best face and it makes it a really good candidate experience. So I think that those are the two things that could fall by the wayside and make things more efficient.
Again, thanks so much for the openness and the great context on all the answers. And thanks for joining us. That'll be the end
Thanks
of
for
today's
having
show, and
me.
we definitely look forward to a follow-up session soon.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Alec.